I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team. I would be very careful about slinging stuff. Am I going to get sued?
Are we legal on this?
I like football. I like football season. All the things that go with it.
Hello and welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Today on Wednesday, December the 6th. No fancy cold open today because, frankly, I couldn't think of one. So instead, we're going to hit the mailbag. We got Brad Spielberger here to help us roll through all the questions and topics that you good people have sent in. How's it going, Brad?
Doing well. How you doing?
Not bad. Not bad. So you've also written an article up on PFF.com that coincidentally hits one of the topics that we had asked of us pretty recently, which is essentially contract year players, guys that have made themselves some money this season with contract season. So we'll get into that as well as part of this show. But before we get into any of that, we have to talk about securing your family's financial future, starting with life insurance. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it quick, easy, and affordable to protect your family so you can get back to enjoying life. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high-quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget with quality policies like $1 million in coverage for less than a dollar a day. Get your personalized quote in minutes and then apply when it's convenient for you. It's all online and on your schedule. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. M-E-E-T, fabric.com/PFFNFL. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. All right, Brad. First question I want to hit. We got one in from Dan Nichols, who, so the subject line of this email went from, you know, 0 to 100 right away. I'm going to modify it a little bit for our purposes. The subject title of this email was, "Why has Aaron Glenn not been fired?" Essentially pointing out that since week 7, the Lions defense has been bottom 3 in the league, and it's clear teams are carving them up in the pass game. Running quarterbacks especially gash this defense. His scheme seems completely incapable of playing at this point. Why has he not been fired yet? Now, you know, we at the PFF NFL podcast don't like to call for people's jobs. So instead, let's simply focus on why this Lions defense is underachieving and is it problematic to the point that it's going to undermine their entire season?
I have a couple thoughts here. I think the first for me, and maybe I should do some more research on this, but it kind of just, I guess, a belief. I do think, more so on defense than offense, you need the horses. Like, you can have a great scheme, you can do different things, get creative. I guess Brian Flores is a phenomenal example of coaching around a deficiency in talent, and it's in the same division, so I guess there's a counterexample. But nevertheless, like, I would say, look at the guys that have developed on this defense. Even a second overall pick in Aiden Hutchinson, I get he's a second overall pick, but his leap has been obvious. Ali McNeil, unfortunately now on IR, is, I think, a budding star on the interior, former third-round pick. You look at a guy like Kirby Joseph, and, you know, when he steps in with Tracy Walker, he takes a leap. Like, there are so many players, Jerry Jacobs, the undrafted corner, where, you know, Malcolm Rodriguez, I know he's now more of a fullback. But, you know, there are so many, you know, guys you can point to as later-round guys or cheaper free agents. Really bringing in Alex Anzalone has a career resurgence back in Detroit. They obviously, you know, shared some time in New Orleans. So, like, I get the question. I actually tweeted out yesterday. Yeah, they're 29th in EPA per play allowed, 30th in success rate allowed since that week 7, half of their season split. I just think, yeah, like, they just still have a talent deficiency there. You know, outside of McNeil and Hutchinson, no one in the front 7 is a difference-making player. Now I'm going to piss off Lions fans. Maybe that's why you don't use your first round picks on a running back and an off-ball linebacker when Jalen Carter or Christian Gonzalez could have been your two picks. I think if you did that, you'd have an awesome defense. So anyway, I get the question. I do. And Glenn has had some issues, but he's also his first couple years there, they put a ton of man. They didn't have the guys to do it. They Jeffrey Okuda in a blender. And I have seen him kind of change things and do things differently. I'm still a believer in Aaron Glenn, but I do get the question.
I think for defense as well, if it's not a star player, we tend to very easily ignore injuries or just put them out of mind. And look, everybody gets injuries. It's part of the gig, but it's you have to factor in what it does to the defense, right? Like if you bring in a bunch of players, if you don't have an incredible level of depth, which you need for a really top level defense, and you get a bunch of significant starters get hurt, the defense is going to get worse. It just is, right? If no matter what scheme you're running, it's almost impossible to withstand a certain volume of injuries hitting this defense. So we credited Detroit in the offseason for some of the moves they made, you know, going and getting a bunch of veteran guys that can man the secondary and sort of prop up that level and say, we have at least a baseline of solid play here. And half of those guys are hurt now, right? And Alex Anzalone, as you said, has had a great season so far. He's hurt. Ilan McNeil is hurt. Like everybody of consequence except Aiden Hutchinson is getting hurt at various points. So it's not the defense that it started off being. And it started off really good. Now, maybe they were overachieving for the first part of the season, and now they're underachieving for the second half. But I think you have to factor in some of the injuries that they've been dealing with this whole process. Now, you know, part of the job of coaching is to figure out a way around that and put the guys that you do have in the best position to succeed. But I just think when we have these conversations, we have to at least acknowledge the players that they've been missing and, you know, critical parts of this defense are not there.
100%. I mean, you lose Chauncey Gardner-Johnson right away and, you know, frankly, been able to fill in with, you know, a Brian Branch, who's been awesome. The Emmanuel Mosley one was huge. Like, I do right. like Jerry Jacobs, but you went out and signed him for a reason. And I think it was a great value deal, too, getting him off the injury. I thought he was playing great ball before then. The last one for me that actually spins positive, because the quote, if I remember correctly, from Dan Campbell was, James Houston could be back in December. That was the timeline we heard. Was it was going to take a long time. He obviously has been out, well, like pretty much the entire season. But December was the beginning of what they thought could be the window. And look, is he a rotational guy? Sure. But they have no pass rush outside of Aiden Hutchinson. Ali McNeil, sure, for what he does as a kind of a 0-1 tech type player, is obviously great at that. But a true, like, pin your ears back, get it for the quarterback type guy outside of Hutchinson, there's been nobody. Maybe James Houston steps in, starts playing like the guy he was last year, and it makes a big difference, because that, I think, has been, as much as the coverage unit has the injuries, I think it also just, like, they don't get any coverage pressure or coverage sacks because guys aren't getting – or, sorry, inverse. Like, they don't get any quick pressure, you know, because it's really just Aiden working by himself, and now teams are chipping him like crazy, doubling him. Like, he gets no one-on-one rushes anymore after his hot start.
Yeah, we have this kind of not a chicken and the egg situation, but like, which is it more at fault here? Is it missing repeatedly on talent acquisition, or is it a scheme that isn't actually getting the best out of the talent that they've acquired? Like, Aiden Hutchinson obviously is emerging as a true superstar as an edge rusher, you know, the number two overall pick, a guy that should have gone number one overall in that draft. So that's the one hit. But outside of that, and Brian Branch, I guess, this year is looking like he's going to be a star as well. But every other defensive pick they've made in the last several years has not panned out yet, right? You look at across the board, Ilan McNeil is starting to play really well, but as you say, as a nose tackle that can get some pressure, there's a kind of limited impact he can have on the pass game. But Levi Onwuzurike hasn't done anything. The Okwaras are not making an impact. Josh Pascal, Charles Harris, who they acquired, like the corners, whether it was Jeffrey Okuda, who they got rid of, whether it's Melifonwu, like a whole bunch of guys that they brought in as part of this rebuild have not been the kind of impact or contributing players that they thought they would be, which is why they had to go back to free agency and bring in, you know, guys like Cameron Sutton and Chauncey Gardner-Johnson and Emmanuel Mosley and, you know, try and sort of stem the bleeding, really, from the fact that all these guys they brought in the draft didn't actually make the impact they thought they would have. So I think that's a question internally for them to go, well, are these guys actually talented playmakers and we're letting them down with the scheme, or have we simply not brought in the players we thought we were going to get and therefore our defense isn't as good as it should be?
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. Like you said, injuries are a part of football. I get that. But like Levi Onwuzurike was a tough one, pretty much out of the gate, a back injury for, I thought, a really fun, promising second-round pick. Like it's been a lot. So I don't know. I think we're on the same page there. Like, you know, it could be better. You know, it started off great, but, you know, it's tough right now. you know, also the offense the last couple of weeks has put them in a lot of tough positions. You know, obviously a ton of turnovers, things of that nature that haven't helped. The defense did step up and kind of seal the game against the Chicago at the end there. Like, you know, they've been able to make some splash plays and make some, you know, bend don't break type of plays over the course of the last couple of weeks. Obviously, you want the underlying metrics to be strong as well, but I don't think they were maybe as good as they were in the beginning, like you said, and they're probably not as bad as the metrics say the last, you know, six games.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, this question comes in. That question was from Ben Nichols, I think, if I didn't mention that before. NFLpodcast@pff.com if you want to email us in any questions or just simply thoughts. This question's come in from the Discord channel. You'll find the link to the Discord in the description of this show. Come join. You can ask questions. You can make picks. You can hang out and chat, all those kinds of things. This question is from the Family Consigliere, who says, big, long question. I'm not going to read all of it out, but essentially it's, how would you define a franchise quarterback in today's NFL? We've discussed this before regarding Will Levis, Sam Howell, or other young quarterbacks that show promise, but it's but are relatively inconsistent. And, you know, now those guys are termed quarterbacks of the future. But in today's NFL, where everybody is now shooting for this superstar, right, your version of Patrick Mahomes or whoever, how are we defining franchise quarterback? When do you determine you have the guy, you're good to build around him, it's time to stop looking and hedging and doing all those kinds of things, but actually deploy all the resources around those guys? Because teams have done that in recent years with mixed success, right? The Eagles finally deployed all their resources around Jalen Hurts, and Jalen Hurts has been a sort of franchise guy, you know, objective top five in almost all metrics one season, right? The Browns essentially deployed all their resources around Baker Mayfield, and a couple of years later got rid of him and then bring in Deshaun Watson. So how do we define now franchise quarterback? What is that? What are we looking for?
Yeah, so for me, look, the supporting cast is always going to matter a lot. Even for the best quarterbacks, they need some help, whether it's protection, pass catchers, a mix of both. But I still do think that at the end of the day, you look at the things that we've defined as more stable and more consistent metrics. So at first, I would start there, you know, clean pocket passing, standard drop back, all of those things. You know, intermediate passing for me is a huge one, especially more and more in today's NFL. Yeah, if you're drafting a guy in the NFL, he probably can throw a 70-yard bomb, and he hopefully can throw a screen pass. Can he consistently win between 10 and 20 yards downfield, over the middle, the boundary, etc.? And then I guess I'll tell people to go look at a graph that got posted this morning by at Throw the Damn Ball, which is Judah Fort Gang, a PFF guy who puts out some of the best gambling content in the world, but also good analysis. Can you – he's created this new create rate. So it's essentially when plays are perfectly covered, which we define with our all coverage data, you know, so it's not just the grades, but every single player, whether targeted or not, essentially, how often can the quarterback still create a positive play or avoid sacks, right? And so if you go look at the top right corner of that metric, there are some surprises, like a Derek Carr, but it's all of the guys that we, you know, it's Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, Justin Herbert, like all these guys that when things aren't going great, they still find a way to produce. And, you know, when the protection's bad, when there's no one open, they still can create plays. It's, again, it's within, you know, there's obviously like parameters to that. Like no one's, if Patrick Mahomes had the worst supporting cast in the NFL, he probably wouldn't be that productive, but he still, I think, would be better than obviously other quarterbacks in the same environment.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the answer to this question is probably not a good one. It's that there is no obvious, like, here's the line. Once you're over this, you've got the guy, let's go. You almost have to determine, first of all, like, is a guy capable, right? Let's start there. So number one is he going to be viable at all? So let's get over that line. And then once you've got that guy, now can he be pretty good? And then once you've got a quarterback that you're pretty sure can be good, now let's start throwing resources at it and see how good he can get. And honestly, you're probably not going to know until that point whether or not you've got a quote-unquote franchise guy. Because remember, like right away, Joe Burrow looked good, but didn't look great until Ja'Marr Chase arrived. Like, we were asking, why can't Joe Burrow throw a deep pass until Ja'Marr Chase rocked up? And it's like, oh, there it is. The LSU Joe Burrow is back because we gave him his teammate, and suddenly the deep ball is there again. But, like, year one, people are saying Justin Herbert is better. Joe Burrow doesn't have an arm good enough for this level. Like, we're focusing on his weaknesses. You know, he's not the greatest athlete in the world. He doesn't have the best arm in the world. You know, people are putting him in the bottom third of NFL quarterbacks. You get Ja'Marr Chase and Joe Burrow looks like Joe Burrow, right? And we catapult from like bottom third to top three. Like, he's now reasonably often put in that 1-2-3 category of the elite quarterbacks in the NFL. If they hadn't brought in Chase, would that have happened at all? Or would Joe Burrow have still looked like a quarterback in the middle of the pack somewhere? And we're like, well, he's clearly good. There's a big upgrade there between whatever, Andy Dalton and Joe Burrow. I don't know if he's great yet. Like, that might be the difference in supporting cast. So I honestly think this is why this is still a difficult job. It might have to be trial and error, right? Get to a guy that you have bought in subjectively, or, you know, all the stuff behind the scenes in the organization. You think he's the right guy, he's a good leader, all that kind of stuff, right? Be happy with that and then just roll the dice and hope that he's the guy if you surround him with enough talent that, oh yeah, look, he does have a Mahomes season in him.
For sure. You know, and I think the big thing there, yeah, obviously the pass catchers are as good as anyone in the NFL. He's never really had, what, maybe above average is the best thing you could say about any offensive line he's played behind.
Right.
Even that might be a touch generous. So, and the scheme, I think Zach Taylor's gotten better and grown and learned, but, you know, they're in shotgun 11 personnel 95% of the time. Like, it's not the most creative offense in the world. So, yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it is an impossible question. If this was an easy question, there wouldn't be, you know, like teams drafting a new guy every couple of years and trying to figure this thing out. It is the hardest thing to do, maybe in all of professional sports, is identify what is a franchise quarterback. That's why there's like a half dozen that we are confident in saying that like in any given year.
And I don't know if this is happening more now or if it's becoming more obvious with how kind of granular we get with all this stuff, but it's not a static baseline. Like, the quarterbacks don't play at the same level year on year on year every single season, and that's the guy you get. Like, we say Patrick Mahomes is the guy, right? He's your gold standard. He's the best quarterback in the NFL. He's the person everybody is shooting for. And Mahomes right now is the sixth graded quarterback in the NFL. Like, he's not playing anywhere near the top quarterback in the NFL. He's like 10 grading points off that spot where he has been in the past and where other players currently occupy. So even the gold standard can drop 10 PFF grading points in a year based off, you know, circumstances or just a bad year. It's more, you know, over a period of time, or if we just sort of assume this level, like, this is where a guy can get to. But it makes it more difficult when you're trying to project, do we have a franchise quarterback, a guy that can be in the Patrick Mahomes tier, or, you know, the Josh Allen, Joe Burrow tier, whatever that sort of 1 or 1A tier of quarterbacks is, or do we simply have a guy who's in the next tier, but in like his best year can put himself in that kind of area? Like, Dak Prescott is now becoming that question, right? Dak Prescott is having an MVP type of season off the back of a year where he led the league in interceptions, and people were wondering, like, is Dak even the guy anymore? Do we need to start looking for a new QB? Did we make a mistake giving him his big long-term contract? And, like, he's gone from one end of the spectrum to the other in a season.
Yeah, he's now going to get a much bigger contract in a matter of months. That actually ties my last point is, and this, I guess, is relevant in this year. I love CJ Stroud. I think he is a top 10 quarterback in the NFL probably. You do, though, need to see, like, Mahomes, for example, went from, you know, this downfield passer to now, like, consecutive years, like, is near the bottom of the NFL on average at the target. But it's not because he's not willing or capable of doing those things. It's because defense has completely adjusted how they play him. I think it's why Josh Allen had so many turnovers last year in the beginning of this year. Maybe Dak, too, to a degree, different players. But, like, can they also – do they have a counter to defense's counters, right? And we talk a lot with, like, you know, Brian Daboll from 2022 to this year. Like, that applies to quarterbacks as well. If you take away something they do very, very well, can they adapt and find different ways to beat you? And so that's going to, you know, it might take an offseason sometimes. It's hard to adjust in season on the fly, but give a defense, you know, every defensive coach in the NFL full offseason to say, okay, What are CJ Stroud's strengths and weaknesses? How can I attack him differently? Again, I think he's very, very good in all the things that are stable and will probably carry over. But yeah, you do need that body of evidence for sure.
And I think this Dak Prescott season also explains why coaches and teams generally are so willing to keep going with a quarterback that is good but may never become great, right? Because this season is probably in there for most of those guys. Like the Vikings with this endless sort of extension of three-year Kirk Cousins deals are waiting for this season, right? They're going, this guy's good. And, you know, when every sort of piece of sort of film or any deeper dive you do on Kirk Cousins, you come away, I think, more appreciative of just how good he is. Like, clearly he's not Patrick Mahomes and almost certainly will never be. But every time you watch him prepare or study or give an answer on anything like X's and O's, you're like, that guy is insanely good. And squeezes like every last ounce of his talent out of there. And the Vikings are looking at this and going, why can't he have a 2023 Dak Prescott season, right? He hasn't had one yet, but if we hit on the next guy, if Jordan Addison comes in and, you know, adds a second receiver to Justin Jefferson and blah, 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 like they keep every year you can talk yourself into the scenario that produces Kirk Cousins having a 93 PFF grade and looking like one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. And if he does that, that's what makes the difference between winning 10 games or winning, you know, 13 close games and being in the playoffs and actually being a real contender. And honestly, it's understandable. Like they take no end of crap for this sort of willing to settle attitude, but it makes sense. Like we know those seasons are in there for most of these quarterbacks. So it is a bit knee jerk instead to be like, no, he's never going to get there. Let's toss it all out and start over again.
Yeah, trying to shoot the moon, I get it. I understand. You elevate your ceiling significantly when you have a cyborg like at Mahomes and Allen, sure. But I do think, as much as I've probably said it myself, like pushing front offices and expecting them to move on from a clear-cut top 12 quarterback, even if the guy is in the 8 to 12 range, not the 1 through 7 range, is kind of delusional and kind of, to a degree, like, yeah, like it's just the odds that they can improve from that, even with – like, it's the funny thing, too, when we talk about, like, upcoming prospects, and I always laugh at these tweets, and people say, like, I saw a tweet the other day, like, Michael Penix's floor is Kirk Cousins. Michael Penix becoming Kirk Cousins is a 90th percentile right. outcome. Like, it's just – and probably higher, frankly, yeah. higher. So, like, I think people will struggle with that because it's this new shiny object. But, like, yeah, like, it's hard to find even a guy who you say year in and year out, he is the unquestioned starting caliber quarterback. There are a dozen of those guys walking the earth at any given time.
It really, it's such a good point. Like Bryce Young is the perfect example, right? Like the thing that sort of you would push these teams to do is, okay, get rid of that guy. He's never going to be the guy. If you have a shot at the next top prospect, go get him. But Bryce Young was, I mean, you know, Steve's made the point there was no consensus number one guy. The betting markets were convinced Stroud was going to be the number one guy, but that wasn't an evaluation. That was an analysis of the fact they thought the Panthers were going to draft him, right? It wasn't that they thought Stroud was better than Young. In fact, before everybody saw Josh McCown, you know, arranging basketball meets with Stroud, everyone was convinced that Bryce Young was the better quarterback, right? If there was a consensus, it was that Young was the better guy. And I'd say you could say there was none. But point being, Bryce Young was seen as the guy, right? The guy that you would dump the average quarterback for to go get the next Bryce Young. Or you can put CJ Stroud into that if you want. And Bryce Young looks awful right now. Like, if you put Bryce Young on the Vikings, it's a better situation than Carolina, but it's not looking as good as Kirk Cousins on the Vikings.
It's the last kind of point. I think the funny, you know, kind of beauty of what happened is, like, Houston realizing, and now we know a lot of the context here, Houston finally being like, you know what, we could trade the number one, and I do think they probably preferred Bryce Young over CJ Stroud.
Right.
It's what I heard. You know, I don't know how true, you know, you never know. but anyway, and they finally sat back and said, you know what, both guys are awesome. We're comfortable with either one. We're comfortable letting the chips fall where they may, and it's our job to just build around the guy we get and you know, maximize his skill set. Because they know, they understand and appreciated the randomness and variance that is the draft. And here we are, you know, flash forward, what, 6 months from then, and we're talking about CJ Stroud as a clear-cut top 10 quarterback, at least in my eyes. And like you said, Bryce, context, huge. He probably been the worst quarterback in the NFL this year. Again, it's been tough surrounding circumstances, but I think you could make that case.
Yeah, go read the article in The Athletic about the dysfunction currently in Carolina and how the Bryce Young situation is there. But this discussion on Houston and CJ Stroud leads us neatly into the next email. This one is from Sean Douse from the UK, it says. I'm going to assume that means Great Britain and Northern Ireland as opposed to Kentucky. Hi, Sam and Steve, and or Brad and Trevor. You're in here as well, which is handy because you're the person we're reading this email to. I know at the time that Houston won their third game of the 2022 season against the Colts, there was a lot of talk that Lovie Smith had potentially cost the Texans massively. However, with the struggles of Young, who the Texans would presumably have taken at number one, and the ascent to stardom of Stroud, could it be argued that what was deemed a meaningless win at the time could in fact be the most significant in the recent history of the franchise? Do the Texans actually owe Lovie Smith a massive thank you for getting that W? So has this meaningless win from Lovie Smith and the Texans actually turned out to be the most impactful win in franchise history?
It might turn out to be the most impactful win for both the Houston Texans and the Chicago Bears franchises in, Houston ever, Chicago in a very, very long time. They obviously were good, you know, before I was born. So, it really could. Lovie Smith is a legend in Chicago already, and that legend could grow if it, you know, gets them a, you know, top two pick this year, and they get their CJ Stroud, and both franchises get it. But, yeah, no, it is. It's very, very funny. I'm sure he loved kind of getting that win and maybe feeling like he was sticking it to them a little bit. Maybe not. He doesn't really seem like that guy. I think he just loves ball and was excited to win a football game. But yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's 100% spot on.
It really highlights how much, you know, you can do all this stuff we talk about, right? Let's try and build towards good process. Let's try and win on the margins. Let's try and steal percentage win rates or percentage points here or there. And you add up all the Al Pacino thing, right? You add up all those inches and that's going to make the difference between winning and losing. But actually what's going to make the difference between winning and losing is getting blind ass lucky and just hitting the other guy, right? Not the one you wanted, not the one you were trying to get. It turns out a lot of people had it wrong and the other guy is the superstar and you didn't see it. And that's the thing that's actually going to make the biggest difference. It's not 100 different edges you've assembled through good process. It's just getting lucky and not picking that guy. I mean, you know, look, there's never an easy control. There's never an easy A-B analysis, right? If you swap CJ Stroud and Bryce Young this season with no other changes, what does that look like? Nobody has any idea, right? CJ Stroud might look exactly like Bryce Young in that Panthers offense right now, i.e. disastrous. And Bryce Young might look like one of the, you know, rookie of the year in the Texans offense with PFF Bobby and the wide receivers who are actually better than people thought they were and an offensive line that's being made look way better by the system and yada yada. Nobody has any idea. Or it might be actually Stroud still is amazing in the Panthers and Bryce Young looks like crap in the Texans offense. Like, that might be the way it is. There's never any way to know. It's all guesswork and conjecture and best analysis, and let's hope we get somewhere near that. But it is amazing that, you know, the Texans were kind of lambasted for not doing that, right? For winning a game that they had no business winning, as opposed to the Eagles a couple of years ago who did the opposite, right? Who basically threw a game that they were about to win so that they could move up a few spots in the draft, and butterfly effect and ripples and all that kind of thing, you can kind of trace where they've built to that game. That being able to move that sparked a trade, sparked blah, 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 and, you know, set those wheels in motion. So in a funny way, like, both ways of doing it have worked out, but for vastly different reasons.
Yeah, so it's funny for a bunch of different reasons. There's so many tentacles there. The Eagles losing is why they had Devontae Smith on their roster.
Right.
They were at 6. They went back down. The funny thing is they then traded up with Dallas from 12 to 10, and Dallas took Micah Parsons. So, like, it's all actually kind of hilarious. Like, Devontae Smith's awesome, but he's not Micah Parsons, and it's in their division. So, the whole thing is hilarious. And also, I would say the Jets winning meaningless games against the Rams and whoever else it was is why there is a calamity going on in New York. And the Jaguars, well, I guess they lost on Monday, but you know, the Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson split is because of meaningless wins for the Jets too. So I would just say this last piece, like, believing that luck could fall in your favor and therefore not forcing the guy you have conviction on actually is good process. And I would say the one exception can be quarterback. If you think there's a franchise quarterback, I'm okay with it. But yeah, other spots, like, that actually is good process, is being, you know, we're at 12 and we might lose our guy at 9, but we like other players. Let's just, you know, whatever. That actually is sound process.
I think with the quarterback, though, if there's a lesson to be learned in it, and there might not be, it might just be this is the nature of quarterbacks. You need to get lucky, otherwise you're screwed. If there is a learning from it, it might be you should only eliminate guys as opposed to fixate on guys, right? Instead of saying, this is definitely the guy, we need him, nothing else matters, only get that guy. It's like, look, if there's something in your analysis, if there's something in your draft prep, your dossier that says that guy cannot be the guy, then sure, write him off. But other than that, just take the quarterback, right? Because you might not have loved Stroud, and it turns out he's amazing. A lot of people didn't like Levis that much. He looks pretty damn good. Like, you might, it seems to be quite easy now for a guy that not you didn't love to actually look way better at the next level. So unless there's like an obvious reason, like, hey, we asked everybody in the building and it turns out he's never looked at tape in his life, you know, the Johnny Manziel stuff. Like, unless there's something like that that shows up in your research, then just take the quarterback. Don't go crazy to get the guy that you have number one in your list of four. Just take one of them, because there's a pretty good chance one of them works out.
You know what that ties perfectly into is research that Timo Riske has done on the website, that when you look at the consensus, there really aren't steals. There are reaches, because it only takes one team to overdraft a player based on consensus. And of course, sometimes they get it right. Vast majority, they do not. There aren't really steals, because if all 32 teams are passing on a guy that we all think is good and the film is good, it's probably because, like you just said, there is some other red flag that comes up throughout the process and teams eliminate him from their board, or at least, you know, until maybe we'll circle back in the fifth, even though he's a second round talent type of thing. Yeah, it ties in very cleanly to that. There are reaches. There are not really steals because those guys are falling for a reason.
Now, of course, the only people that do worse when it comes to their hit rate on selecting quarterbacks at the top of the draft is the PFF experts in here with their price picks. Eli is still battling back. He's trying to bounce back from Travis Etienne screwing him in Monday Night Football. He's got his lineup for this week. He's got T.J. Hockenson going for more than 52.5 receiving yards. He's got Nico Collins going for more than 57.5 receiving yards, and he's got Adam Thielen going for more than 55.5 receiving yards. He is convinced that this is the week that the price picks come in and Eli makes bank, gets up to 25x's money, and absolutely cashes in. We will see. We will see. We haven't yet figured out whether Eli is, in fact, in the community plays along with other superstars like rapper Meek Mill and comedian Andrew Schultz. I assume it's just a matter of time before he gets himself in there. Under the promos tab of the app, you can find those community plays along with entries of some of the biggest names in the Prize Picks community each week. And, of course, Prize Picks offers a reboot policy so that your entries stay in play even if one of your players gets injured. For football and basketball, if you have a player who exits the game in the first half and does not return in the second, that player is rebooted. Prize Picks is the only daily fantasy sports platform with an injury insurance policy. Go to prizepicks.com/PFFNFL and use code PFFNFL for a first deposit match up to $100. Again, that's prizepicks.com/PFFNFL and use code PFFNFL for a first deposit match up to $100. All right, Brad, we're going to get to your article now. We had an email come in, actually, along these lines from Nick from Tennessee, who essentially says, highlight some players that made themselves the most money for this upcoming free agency. So you have an article on PFF.com that does exactly that. It is entitled Pending 2024 NFL Free Agents. You can tell the CEO, the SEOs at work here, who have raised their stock the most this season. So, all right, who's on your list of players that have had these contract years and made bank?
Yeah, I'll start with one. I shared this anecdote on a Ravens podcast yesterday, but I thought it was kind of funny. I think the number one answer is Justin Madubuike with the Baltimore Ravens, their interior defender. It's funny. I tweeted this like a month ago, and I had an agent, and always the caveat, not his agent, because that wouldn't be that surprising, but a different agent was like, yeah, I think you're right. I think this guy has raised his stock more than anyone, and the timing is also phenomenal because we saw – the explosion in this market, not only with extensions, but also, you know, with your Draymond Joneses, your Zach Allens of the world, getting these really, really strong free agent deals. That BK is a better player than both of those guys. I could argue maybe in both facets as a pass rusher and a run defender, at least this year, no question. Overall, I think he's just had a more of a consistent down-to-down player, high effort, high motor, pursuit plays type of stuff. I think he's just kind of taken that step. More refinement in his game, just more counters to different things. And obviously Mike McDonald is getting career years out of half of the defense at this point. So Madubuike is one I wanted to highlight. I can just run through it. You can maybe kind of throw some questions at me or highlight some guys. So Josh Dobbs, obvious, you know, he's now going to be cemented as a number two, really was a number three for most of his career. Our guy, Kevin Dotson with the Rams, we've always liked him, always been a good pass protector, but, you know, his overall grade is, I think, second in the NFL among guards now. Lloyd Cushenberry in Denver, the center, again, always been a good player, but I think more consistent. Austin Jackson in Miami, awesome fourth-year breakout for a former first-rounder. Jonathan Greenard with the Houston Texans. Andrew Van Ginkle in Miami. Blake Cashman with the Houston Texans, the linebacker. Jalen Johnson with the Bears, always been a good player, but playing at an elite level. Geno Stone, the safety with the Ravens. And last but not least, Xavier McKinney with the New York Giants.
So I just want to zoom out a second. This is your kind of world. We had somebody question this a while ago. How real is the contract year phenomenon in the NFL? Like, that's one of those things that's been talked about for years and always in like abstract terms of just anecdotally, hey, this guy had a great season, it's a contract year, this, you know, how real is that as an actual thing, and how powerful is it?
So it's a great question, and the biggest thing, the template answer I could give is that not all contract years are created equal. And I mean like good contract years, right? Like there are some players where people kind of think, yeah, this guy just turned on the effort and the motor a bit more, and that's why there was more production. There are others where they say he was young coming in. I think the game just kind of slowed down for him a little bit, or maybe he was deployed more favorably. And so that, you know, the effort was always there. The attention to detail, the all those things was always there. It just, you know, it just not everything clicked, and it finally clicked. So there are two buckets. And I think that's a big one for me with Madubuike. Not that I think Zach Allen and Draymond Jones are hard workers too, but I think like that was never in question with him. So right. He's going to have, by a landslide, his most pressures, his most sacks, his highest pass rush win rate. Like, everything for him is going to be a career high. But the baseline was also pretty high to begin with. Like, he's a high 60s, low 70s graded guy the first 3 years. He just might be like a low 80s this year, with all those stats to back it. And I don't think it's because, oh, he turned on the Jets. I don't want to, like, throw a player under the bus. It's also my opinion. I haven't heard anything. But, like, I don't know. I think there are some guys you can look back historically and just be like, you know, there, you see some loafage, you know, on tape, and then he's always had the athletic ability and the talent. And then that last year before the contract, you know, all of a sudden he has a phenomenal, phenomenal year. So yeah, there is a ton of research that goes into that. They, you know, I'm sure teams kind of try to find out as much as they can in that regard of where it's coming from, or form their own opinion based on tape and things like that. But yeah, it's a great question, and I'll tell you, like, it's something that, now that I'm kind of in this space and you have that chatter, like, I'll get asked, like, why do you think this guy's grades are so much higher in that contract year than years past? And I'll kind of go in the film and try to get a good answer, at, you know, one man's opinion, but try to say, hey, I think it's this or I think it's that.
Yeah, there's definitely a degree to which, for the first contract guys, the contract year meshes with just the development arc for players in the NFL anyway. So many of these, what are going to get, you know, termed contract year breakouts, or just the guy just hit that point in the NFL where he's good now, you know, like it was more of a grind for the first few years, and now he's in his zone, he's in his prime, he's hitting the level that you're paying for anyway, so it makes sense for him to have a contract year now. I think you're right, it's a good point to distinguish those guys from the guys that are already on a second or a third contract and they have a breakout, you know, contract year. That's not even necessarily more of a red flag, but more of a, that's actually a contract year as opposed to the contract year just lining up with his growth as a player.
Very good point. And so the other thing also, just keep shouting out our guy Timo, but, you know, all he does is do phenomenal work. Like, I've shared the article of his where it talks about kind of the trajectory for each position, right? Like the how long it takes to adjust to the NFL game. You know, off the top of my head, I think it's like tackles, linebackers, you know, can take a while. Other positions, you know, running back, you can hit the ground running and be really good right out of the gate. So that's part of it too. Like off-ball linebacker is one of the slower ones. Tight end is one of the slower ones. I guess there's one example. Like Tremaine Edmonds last year, at least what I saw on tape, was we already had a ton of positives. He was top five in the NFL in defensive stops. He was his first 3 years or 4 years. But there were so many negative snaps.
Right.
And last year, I don't think he added more positives. I think he just had way fewer negatives. And I didn't see the negatives as he wasn't giving max effort. I was like, I think he just was like, didn't really know what he was trying to accomplish on a handful of snaps here and there. And his fifth year, I think he kind of just – the game slowed down. He also was a 20-year-old rookie. So, like, the veteran one is interesting. The example that came to mind when you said that – because it can be both directions. But for me, like, people might say, oh, Jadeveon Clowney signs all these one-year $10 million deals. He finally has to sign a one-year $3 million in Baltimore, and now he's having maybe the best season of his career. I could get why people would say, you know, is he trying to cash in again? To me, he complained a bunch in Cleveland about how he was being deployed, and maybe it wasn't entirely his fault. But they fire Joe Woods, they bring in a new defensive coordinator in Jim Schwartz, and everyone on the defense is having a career year in Cleveland. And also, like I said, everyone with Mike McDonald is having an awesome year too. Like, that matters too. Like, you look at a receiver, did he get a quarterback that can actually throw him the ball that changes things? Did he get a new coordinator? So there's so much context to it. It's a good question. It's a mystery that teams are trying to solve a ton.
And with Clowney in particular, like I would argue most of his career at this point has now been years where he should have been motivated to get the big deal. You know what I mean? Like he's almost been betting on that for the last 5 or 6 years. Like maybe you can argue that, okay, he finally got fed up of that with the last year in Cleveland. But like every other year, he should have been trying to have this season that he's having right now, because that's what's going to get him the contract that he's looking for. Like the long, big money extension, like the monster deal that theoretically should be out there for a young, talented, physically able pass rusher and has never manifested for Clowney. So yeah, I don't think that that's a great argument for people who are like, oh, this year is an obvious contract season for him. One of the names that I thought was really interesting from your list is Geno Stone from the Ravens as well. I like Stone, and he's one of these guys who, again, it's meshing contract year with that developmental arc, right? And he's gotten better every year of his career. Basically didn't play, then played a little bit with a grade in the 60s, then played more with a grade in the 70s, and now he's having this career year with a grade in the 80s. Having said that, and I think he's playing well, but he's also having one of these years that reminds me a lot of the year where Jarius Byrd led the NFL in interceptions, where he made the plays, but there was also just a freakish volume of passes that happened to be thrown right at him. And it's like, yeah, okay, credit him for catching the ball and making the interception, but that's not going to happen every year. Like, Geno Stone this year had 6 interceptions, and a ton of these passes just seem to have been floated in his general area of the defense anyway. So I'm fascinated now by this guy who is definitely having a career year, and it is, you know, descriptive and correct to credit him for the plays he's making and say, this is good defense, congratulations, he's earning, you know, a contract. But it also looks, it's one of those things that seems wildly non-predictive to me. Like, you look at his season this year, if I was a guy writing the check for his contract next year, right? Like, he's a great player, he's coming off a great year, we give him the big money, I would be terrified that that just evaporates in an instant.
I'm super glad you brought this one up. I did actually kind of allude to it in the article itself a little bit, but kind of a teaser, I guess, for free agent content. A focus of mine this offseason to improve everything we do with free agency, but of course, you know, projections, whatever, is more and more focused on archetypes and subpositions and subcategories within a position. And the ball hawking deep third free safety that doesn't really defend the run and come down and make plays in the box, that can't really take on slot receivers and man or just number three receivers and play some snaps like that, those guys don't get paid. You look historically, like even an Anthony Harris gets tagged but then gets nothing in free agency, like a Xavier Woods, a Trey Boston. We've seen guys, they grade super high, they have ball production, and they don't get paid at safety in particular. That is one of the more obvious and easy ones I've discovered over the last couple of years of doing this, and now in backtesting a lot of what I'm working on right now, getting ready for this offseason, is like the safeties that get paid a ton are guys that can come down and make plays in the box, that can, you know, the Kyle Hamiltons, the Derwin Jameses, the Minkah Fitzpatrick, obviously those are premier, you know, elite players, but the lesser, you know, of those guys is going to make more than, yeah, a good ball hawking deep third guy. But it's like, yeah, teams are going to say, yeah, but like we could just throw a guy back there who could probably do that, do what he did for very, very cheap. We're not going to spend gangbusters on it. Yeah, so great point. And yeah, like I – of that list of 11, if I had to say which guy would you be surprised if he still doesn't have that strong of a market, it would be Geno Stowe.
Yeah. One of the names, though, I think that's really interesting is Blake Cashman, who, you know, what was he, a fifth-round pick back in 2019, a little bit undersized, probably not as much as I think people think he is because he's sort of stumpier rather than like just tiny. He's like six, he's listed at 6'1", 237, but he had crazy short arms. We looked up his numbers on the Monday show, I think. But he started off the season with this crazy run of incredible grading, and it's maintained. It hasn't disappeared. It's not gone away in this defense. So Blake Cashman is legitimately having this incredible career year, already has a career high for playing time, right? He's already got like 100 more snaps than he's ever had in a single season before. So he's finally getting a chance to just be on the field first and foremost. But he's grading well in every single aspect that we measure. Run defense, tackling, pass rush coverage, all in the green or blue. Defensive grade overall, all that rolled together, and penalties and discipline. It's 89.8, so right up there with the elite linebackers in the NFL. He's this fascinating guy of someone who just got given an opportunity and is playing incredibly well. He played well in college. He doesn't necessarily fit the overall prototype, but then in this trend of there's always confounding factors, right? You have a great defensive scheme coming over, right? A new head coach, and the head coach, DeMeco Ryans, is bringing over this system that has been dominant in San Francisco as well. So to what extent, again, if you're the buyer team, if you're out there with the checkbook, how much are you looking at this and saying, okay, this is Blake Cashman finally getting an opportunity and playing well, versus to what extent is he a product of this defensive system that he's in now that's making everybody look good suddenly?
Yeah, it's a great point. And also just even the system's a huge part of it, but also like defensive lines he's been playing behind in Houston have been arguably the worst defensive lines in the NFL until this season, where you bring in Will Anderson, Jonathan Greenard is in the article, their other edge rusher opposite of Will Anderson, and you're having great play from Malik Collins has been there, but having a good season, Sheldon Rankins, a new addition as well. So yeah, that position is obviously dependent a ton on the guys playing in front of them. I think for linebacker, a cool thing that I've noticed so far is you got to have one, whether it's coverage, pass rush, or run defense, like one thing that you're very, very good at. If you're just like above average or good at all of them, I think, again, those guys can fall through the cracks and not get very strong deals. He's always been really good coming forward. And even when he hasn't played a lot, has a lot of production coming forward as an occasional blitzer. And now he's just with way more reps, like you said. He's almost played more snaps this season than all seasons combined prior, but also been good as a coverage player and as a run defender. Yeah, he'll be a fascinating one. It'll be very, very interesting. It's also interesting. I mean, Caserio traded for him before, you know, DeMeco got there. It's not like he traded for him for DeMeco Ryans. He traded for him for Lovie Smith, who runs a different defense almost entirely. Obviously, you know, all defenses are kind of, you know, they cross over. But anyway, so yeah, like he's had a great year. It's been cool to see. And yeah, you know, it's, I guess, a good example. Again, I don't think they're very similar players at all. But like, yeah, Azeez Al-Shaair didn't have a super strong market, you know, this past offseason. He did play a bunch because Dre Greenlaw went down. He was productive in San Fran. Actually, think he's been pretty good as a Titan. I think he's an awesome guy coming forward as well. Good run defender. Can blitz the passer a little bit. Not a great coverage player. That position's been tough. Safety and linebacker in free agency has been very, very tough. My projections have been the worst on those, you know, just because – well, it's like not even like missing wildly. I mean, some of them have, but like it's just like the market falls off a cliff really, really quick. There's no middle market for those guys. Either you make the 7, 8, 9 million, or you get a minimum. You get a minimum contract. Like that's it.
Doesn't it feel like teams are also getting a little bit wiser now, though, to this impact of scheme on both sides of the ball? Like guys that are having incredible years in a system that you know is good, is really good, and is boosting the production of everybody. I think in years past, teams would have just looked at that and said, he's playing great, throw the bag at him. And now they're like, okay, come on. Like, we know at least some of this is the scheme and how much, and let's dig into it deeper and let's be a little bit more careful. Like, I think genuinely, we constantly, like articles like that Carolina thing come out, and you're like, you see, the NFL is as dumb as ever. But they're really not. Like, I think the longer we go, the more you're aware of how smart they are at some of this stuff, you know, and they are way better than they used to be at not doing incredibly stupid things in, you know, in off seasons just because it looks like something's happening. Now, that being said, the last guy I want to talk about from your article, Austin Jackson, and the power of the lingering first round draft pick status. Because I think you're right. He's having a career year. I would argue that that career year is still not particularly good. And even the year at the moment is like the last two of the last three games have been his best games of the season. And they've come against a team that just traded away their edge rushers and a team that only has one edge rusher who, you know, has been hurt for a bit. So is Austin Jackson actually going to get paid? And if he is it off the basis of the fact that he was the number 18 overall selection a few years ago and teams hate acknowledging that a guy that was a first round pick might just not be a good player?
Yeah, it influences every single contract in the NFL, extensions, free agency, no question about it. I think it's kind of funny, you know, like an Isaiah Wynn, who's now on Miami, who was similar, 23rd overall to the Patriots. I guess injury is more of a factor there, but Jackson's a good question because I think it goes back to, is the development timeline just, you know, look, again, I think he was 20 years old when he was drafted as well.
Very young.
Out of USC. And I agree with you. The true pass set stuff is still not very good. You have the fastest average time to throw in the NFL. So he's being protected. Like, talk about players at a particular position that benefit from their scheme. If you're a 49ers offensive lineman, you're getting like an 80 grade. It's like, it just because it's just so helpful and beneficial to what you're trying to accomplish. So I think there will be teams, like you said, teams are way, way smarter about this. He'll still get a solid deal. But even 5 years ago, like, he may have signed like a crazy big contract. Yeah. It all would have been like, what is going on? He'll get a solid deal. And maybe it still might be a little bit more than we think he's worth. But teams are sharper now. But at the same time, though, like, you could also say, well, like, 24, he's going to be 24 in August, next August. Like, he's still, you know, so. But anyway. Long answer short, yeah, he's a fascinating one. The rest of the season probably will tell us a lot. Playoffs, maybe if Tua in bad game script, stuff like that, we'll go a long way there. But yeah, that's an impossible one for sure.
You don't have to go back very far to find a time where, like, he would be on his way to being like the best paid right tackle in the NFL. And not only, but the scary thing is, you would have had a few people doing what you said, which is going, why have they given him that deal? You would have had a bunch of other people saying, this is the best right tackle in the NFL. He's only given up, you know, one sack in the last 2 years, and he just got paid, and he's a former first-round pick. Like, it would work. Just simply giving him that contract would actually create this narrative that this former first-round pick is now, you know, one of the best offensive linemen in the NFL, but now there's actual data to check this stuff, and the film is out there for everybody to see, and you're like, he isn't. Like, this is just insane.
Yeah, he like, an anecdote from the PFF book, like, he'd make a Pro Bowl and you have Neil calling the voter being like, who the hell voted for this guy for the Pro Bowl? Like, you know, that's where we're at this point.
Why is the former first round pick stuff still so powerful?
I think there's some reasons that make it that are legitimate, some are not. So first, when you are a first round pick, that probably means you're a great guy for the most part. Obviously, there are exceptions, but like, you're passing all of those tests too. So, you know, that's going to carry forever. And that, you know, good leader, smart guy, watches film, practices hard, no red flags, etc. Again, that's not everyone. Right. So that should carry. But then also, I think it's, you probably also did test very well, so you probably are a very good athlete. So, you know, the kind of the buy-in of being like, the film's not clean. Maybe you could tell yourself, obviously it doesn't apply to Austin Jackson in Miami, but this team didn't use him properly, or this team stunk or was dysfunctional or whatever. But if we get our hands on him in a good building, we can turn that around. And there probably are success stories of that nature. But yeah, it's also just, I think, like you said, still there's optics about it. Fans, oh, we signed a former first round pick. Like, remember, what was it, last year or 2 years ago when the Atlanta Falcons had, like, their entire offense was former first-round picks? And it was like, yeah, Laquan Treadwell is really going to break out in Atlanta, along with all the other former first-round picks they signed that are probably no longer in the league. Like, there's just a lot of positivity and upswell to it. But also, yeah, teams are still probably convincing themselves, we loved him in the pre-draft process, we liked meeting him, he was a good guy, and this team just didn't know how to use him, but we do. And they're probably, you know, correct in that assessment, I don't know, 20% of the time.
All right, well, that'll do it for our show today. Go and read Brad's article on PFF.com. Steve will be back tomorrow as we preview every single game of this week. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.